Good morning, friends, and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm your host, John Sloop, along with my co-hosts, Rita Dunaway and Dean Welty. Today, we're going to be talking about the little-known provisions of Article 5 of the Constitution. And Rita is going to introduce us to that in just a moment. But first, let me lay some groundwork. Did you know that God designed society to work under certain structures and frameworks? For instance, God created man and woman and designed the institution of marriage, with designated roles for the husband and wife. That's a subject we'll be coming back to in more detail in upcoming programs. But God designed the family, the most basic building block of society, to have a certain area of responsibility. Parents nurturing and training children, and grown children caring for parents. And He designed the church to occupy another sphere of responsibility, to evangelize and spread the gospel, to teach the scriptures and disciple the nations, to engage in corporate worship, administer the sacraments, and to care for the lost, the lonely, and the least in society. Most Christians probably recognize that God had a particular design for the church and the family, but did you know that God designed civil government to perform certain functions as well? Namely, to administer justice by punishing evildoers. You can read about that in Romans 13 and 1 Timothy 2, 1 through 2. Also, to protect citizens from aggression. That's covered in Genesis 10 through 12. And yes, even to tax citizens to provide for the legitimate functions of civil government. And you can read about that in Romans 13, 6. So as Americans, we are blessed to live in a nation that was founded upon biblical principles of authority and limited government. Dean, why don't you summarize for us a few of these ways the design of our government reflects biblical principles?
Thank you, John. You know, I'm really glad you mentioned the foundation that we have on the Bible for our government. You mentioned those principles. There's one more I would add to what the Bible instructs us to do, and that reflects the program we're on, which is Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. He's instructed us to be salt and light in this culture and in the public square. And so that's where we take off. I have in front of me, John, three documents. One is the Bible. The other is the Declaration of Independence, and the third one is the Constitution. These three documents are woven together in our history as one document with a common set of principles. For example, and I'm going to do a little bit of background here to set it up for Rita talking about the Constitution. Our early settlers and our founding fathers really established this concept of covenants, God's covenant with his people, his covenant with Noah and with Moses and with Abraham and with David. They brought that concept of covenants into their local colonial governments that were all biblically based. For example, this was new to me until recently, all 50 of our state constitutions refer to God. So he is the basis for all of our government from the Pilgrims and the Puritans up until today. Now, the Pilgrims started this with the Mayflower Compact. They said, "We are coming to America for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith." So that reverence for God and for his laws permeate the Declaration of Independence. There are four references to God in the Declaration of Independence. First of all, the laws of nature and of nature's God. Secondly, we are endowed by our Creator with certain rights. Thirdly, there is a reference to appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions. And then finally, appealing to divine providence for our protection as we go to war. So this really brings us all to the Constitution. Now, just a word about that. Those biblical principles that you just mentioned are all embodied in the preamble to the Constitution: to establish justice, biblical, to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and for our children. Now, one final comment about the Constitution and how a biblical principle is incorporated in that. Our founding fathers knew that the heart of man was deceitful and desperately wicked. You cannot entrust power into the hands of one or a few. That explains the reason for the separation of powers. We have three branches of government. Each one of those branches plays the role of a check and balance on the other branches of government. And I'll finish with this. Our founders knew this danger of too much power. That is why they organized the Constitution in this way, and I'm getting ready to hand it off to Rita with this quote from Thomas Jefferson. In questions of power, then, let no more be said of confidence in man, but rather bind him down from mischief by the chains of the Constitution.
That's pretty powerful.
Right. Thanks for that great introduction, Dean, to the topic. Now, in addition to the checks and balances you mentioned, which are an essential feature of our constitutional system, we all learn in school that the federal government was designed to exercise specific enumerated powers. Well, does anyone at this table think that is how the federal government is operating today?
Not really.
No.
Well, yeah,
no,
it's very simple. They're all specific and enumerated.
The federal government, as you all can see, has taken over the fields of education, social welfare programs, health care even. It governs virtually every type of economic activity. In fact, I'm hard-pressed to think of any area in which the federal government does not legislate, mandate, and regulate. Did you know, just to try to make it tangible, the Code of Federal Regulations, now these are laws enacted by bureaucrats, it is over 200 bound volumes. If you stack those books on top of each other, they are over 20 feet high. And every year, about 4,000 pages of new regulations are added. But the key point here is that most of this lawmaking and regulating that the federal government is doing is on topics that it does not even have a legitimate source of authority to be regulating.
But Rita, I just have a question, and I know John's going to take off from here, but aren't you grateful that the government is looking after you the way it does? It's doing it for your good.
No, thank you very much. I'd like for them to go back into their proper spheres of authority.
Rita, how did we get into this mess? If the federal government doesn't have power under the Constitution to require Americans to go out and buy health insurance, how is it getting away with doing so?
That's a great question. Has either of you ever heard about this theory of the organic Constitution?
Yes.
Is that a little bit like a living and breathing document?
Exactly. <Yeah.
laughs> Living and breathing.
Well, there are a lot of politicians and judges and Supreme Court justices today who believe in this idea that our Constitution is a living, breathing document, like Dean said. They really believe that the Founding Fathers purposefully wrote the Constitution to be vague so that its meaning would change on its own along with cultural trends and popular opinion. This organic Constitution philosophy has merged with a progressive worldview to really erase all meaningful limitations on federal power. Let me just give you one example. The Interstate Commerce Clause. It originally meant that Congress would have power to regulate the interstate shipping of goods, shipping between states. Today, it is interpreted so broadly as to give the federal government power over anything and everything related to trade or production. You know, if Congress can force me to go out and buy the health insurance product that it wants me to have, what can't it force me to do? So the Supreme Court actually legitimizes the perversion of our federal system every time it dreams up some way to interpret the Constitution to approve of power grabs like Obamacare. On multiple occasions, the court itself has recognized the breathtaking scope of its ability to effectively change the Constitution through judicial interpretation. And I want to give you a quote. As far back as 1936, Justice Harlan Stone said this, "While unconstitutional exercise of power by the executive and legislative branches of government is subject to judicial restraint, the only check upon our own exercise of power is our own sense of self-restraint." Well, I don't want to live in a country where a court is only restrained by its own sense of self-restraint, which has not exactly been a hallmark of the judicial branch.
Rita, you have mentioned all three branches in your statement just now. You've mentioned the executive, you mentioned the congressional. Now, we expect the judiciary to act as a check on each of those branches. But going back even further than, what did you say, 1935 with Harlan Stone, 36? Jefferson said, and I love this quote, "The Constitution is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they please." Already he was concerned that the judiciary was not going to exercise its true accountability to the wording and the intent of the Constitution.
Time has proven him exactly right.
Yep. Well, Rita, I know that you're excited about this Convention of States project, this initiative based on Article 5 of the Constitution as a way to address this power grab and power overreach. So explain that to us. How does it work?
Well, in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention, George Mason specifically predicted that one day the federal government would overpower the states and the states would need a recourse. And that is precisely why he insisted that this provision be added to Article 5 of the Constitution, providing a way for states to propose constitutional amendments that check and balance the federal government, including the Supreme Court. Under Article 5, there are two ways to amend the Constitution. Either method, the proposed amendments have to be ratified by 3/4 of the states. That's 38 states have to ratify.
And that's not an easy thing to do.
That's right. That is a challenge. The distinction between the two ways of amending the Constitution is in who proposes the amendments. Congress can propose the amendments, which is the way it's always been done in the past, or 2/3 of the states, that's 34 states, can apply for a convention to propose amendments on a particular subject. If they do that, if 34 states apply for a convention on the same topic, Congress is required to issue the formal call that sets the time and place for the meeting. And then Congress has to stand back and let the state delegations work out the wording of proposed amendments that will resolve the problem at hand. Then proposals go to the states for ratification. So the Convention of States Project, the specific effort that I'm working for under the direction of Michael Ferris and Mark Meckler, has formulated an application for this Article 5 convention to propose amendments that will do three things: impose fiscal restraints on the federal government, limit the power and jurisdiction of the federal government, and set term limits for federal officials. And I just have to add here that our project is just over a year old, and we have already passed our application entirely in three states, Georgia, Florida, and Alaska. And this year we expect to have our resolution considered in at least 30 to 34 additional states.
And Rita, once a state like Georgia signs on, that means they're signed on for the long haul.
Yes, that's right. Unless they later rescind their application, it does not expire.
Okay.
They don't have to keep doing it. And I should mention here that it just has to be passed through the legislature of the state. It does not require a governor signature.
Well, Rita, I have a couple questions about this. A lot of people have concerns about the Convention of States. I have concerns about the Convention of States. And I think if we're not concerned about it, we're not paying attention. All of us know the story of the Articles of Confederation and how people took that. It wasn't strong enough, and so they wanted to strengthen it, but they ended up scrapping it and adopting a whole new constitution. Just a couple comments on what you said, though. This one amendment was about fiscal restraint. I just checked this earlier this week. Our national debt, anybody want to guess? $18 trillion. Now, that per citizen, John, that includes you, that is $56,000 per citizen in debt. Now, per taxpayer, that includes you, $154,000. So there's definitely something has to be done to impose fiscal restraint. So my question here, Rita, first of all, what is wrong with the Constitution? We have a good Constitution. Our founders were regarded as almost demigods in what they created. So first of all, what are the problems in the Constitution that you're trying to fix? And then secondly, isn't it just good enough to elect better people? Elections are important. If we can just elect good people, that will fix the problem without going to the risk of a convention of states.
That's a great question, Dean. I'll be happy to answer it. But first, I have to back up for a minute and take issue with something you said. There's a common myth out there that was actually, if you trace it back, it was promoted by liberal groups beginning in the 1960s, that our Constitution is some illegitimate result of a runaway convention. That is actually not the case. If you look up the historical documents and see the actual instructions the states gave to their delegates, you will see that the delegates did exactly what they were instructed to do, and our Constitution is absolutely legitimate, but maybe that's for another program. But to your question about, you know, what's wrong with the Constitution, how is amending it going to help? It's a really good question. Most of the problems that we're facing now are the result of constitutional interpretations, as I was describing a minute ago. The Supreme Court has capitalized on ambiguities in the wording of certain phrases, like the General Welfare Clause, to provide for the general welfare in Article 1. Well, we know what that originally meant, but the wording is a little bit vague, and so now the court interprets that as an unlimited power to tax and spend. So we can restore the federal government to the proper limitation that was intended by the General Welfare Clause by clarifying the original meaning of phrases and clauses that have been perverted like that through constitutional amendments. So through clear, specific wording, we can effectively overturn those bad Supreme Court precedents that have eviscerated our federal system. And as to your follow-up question about, you know, what about just electing good people? Well, even if we elected a wonderful Congress tomorrow, every member being a constitutional originalist, that would not do anything to fix those bad precedents that are in place. So even if we had a good Congress for a few years, as soon as the next batch came on that wanted to take advantage of these loopholes that have been opened by the court, we would be right back in the situation we're in today.
And Rita, in the time that I've been observing politics, I've noticed how a good candidate with no term limits can continue to be reelected, and then they become part of the institution. Dean loves to quote the guy in Virginia that was running for lieutenant governor or something, who said there ain't no such thing as a self-butchering hog.
Yeah, that was Delegate Scott Lingenfelter, yes. our sponsor.
Yes, and that's so true. Once they get the power, going back to Dean's statement about the fallen nature of man, they don't want to give up that power. They want to increase their power to stay in power, and that's why their terms need to be limited.
Well, okay, I have an add-on question to that, though. I've been married for 44 years. You got a problem with that?
Of course not.
Well, but I'm saying that there are good marriages, there are good politicians. Why should we force them out of office just because they've been there a certain number of years? Why, going back to my 44 years of marriage, the length of time isn't the problem. It's the quality of service, is it not?
Well, you're talking about the term limits,
term limits
idea.
Yes.
Well, the founding fathers, I think it's very clear, never intended for us to have career politicians, because what can happen is a career politician, even with the best intention, over time can tend to become unaware or just too far removed from what's actually going on down in the trenches of regular American life. And I also want to add that under our application, term limits is one topic of amendments that could be proposed under our application for a convention of states. It doesn't mean that term limits for members of Congress have to be proposed. The state delegations could very well decide, well, we're not going to limit the term for members of Congress, but we want to limit the term of office for federal judges. How do you like that idea, Dean?
Well, I like that idea for five of them. Well, let me go on with another question that comes up frequently. Article 5 says that Congress calls the convention. So won't Congress control the convention? It goes back to John's point. There ain't no such thing as a self-butcher and hog. And if we allow them to control the convention, won't they simply perpetuate their power?
That's another misconception. Article 5 does give Congress the ministerial duty of issuing the formal call. But that word call is sort of a term of art when it comes to interstate conventions. And what it means is setting the date, time, and location of the convention. And just to give an example to back that up, did you know Virginia actually called the Philadelphia Convention in 1787? Well, that didn't give Virginia control over the whole thing. Virginia didn't get to select the delegates from other states or unilaterally determine the rules. So, no. The whole reason we have the convention mechanism in Article 5 is to give the states a way to bypass Congress to achieve the amendments that the states and the people need. So it wouldn't have made any sense to use a mechanism that still gives Congress control.
Well, then, Rita, how does voting actually happen at the convention?
Voting happens on a one state, one vote basis. It is not a convention of delegates. It's a convention of states. And the Article 5 language is clear that everything is done by states. The number needed to trigger the convention, the number needed to ratify the amendments, and the universal precedent for interstate conventions is one state, one vote.
All right, Rita, I've got one more question, but I think it's the one that we hear most often, and that is a fear of a runaway convention. There are going to be renegades coming in there, they're going to take over the convention, and we're going to end up with a worse product than the one we have.
Yeah, that is definitely a common fear, but as I said before, there's absolutely no precedent for a runaway interstate convention. There's no precedent for it, and there are redundant protections in place against amendments that would go beyond the scope of the convention. The first layer of protection is the topic defined in the 34 applications that trigger the convention. As I said, our application is limited to amendments that limit or restrict the federal government. Any proposals that go beyond that scope would be out of order and improper. The second layer of protection is that the convention delegates are the legal agents of their state legislatures. They represent their states, and the state legislatures can recall them. The state legislatures give them their instructions, and those instructions are binding. Third layer, even if the state legislatures failed to step in and remove delegates who acted beyond the scope of their powers, and even if a majority of the state delegates voted to propose amendments that were out of order. And even if Congress then said, we're going to go ahead and submit those out of order amendments for ratification, then we would call upon the courts to step in and invalidate that.
The courts and that we trust.
The courts get into trouble when they're called to interpret language that is somewhat vague. There's nothing vague about this. The scope of our application is clear and defined. The instructions given by state legislatures will be in modern, clear language. There's no room for error there in the legal process. And finally, the most important layer of protection is that 38 states have to ratify any proposed amendments. That is a huge hurdle.
I've heard some people claim, and this is kind of interesting, that the very progressive George Soros and other big money liberals are the ones actually behind the Convention of States movement for their own nefarious purposes. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I've heard that a lot too, Doc, and it actually kind of makes me giggle. The truth is there are a lot of different groups out there working to achieve an Article 5 convention to propose a bunch of different types of amendments. And, you know, it's a constitutional process. It is a process of self-government. Those groups, including the ones led by George Soros, have every right to try to use Article 5 to get a convention to propose the amendments they want. But the point here is that those groups, George Soros and the rest of them, they are not supporting our effort. They're not supporting the Convention of States project to limit the federal government because they know just as well as we do that that scope, that topic defined in our application is binding. And they know that they cannot use our effort to achieve their goals and their purposes.
Rita, I notice we have a few more minutes. Help us understand the history of this. Has it ever been tried before successfully? And have there been other attempts to call for a convention of states in our history?
Yeah, there actually have been. There have been hundreds of applications by the states for an Article 5 convention. The reason we've never had one is because we have never had 34 states apply for a convention on the same topic. So that, again, is proof that the topic set forth in the application is worth something. It is meaningful. It is binding, and it counts. So the 34 states have to apply on the same topic.
I know that Virginia legislature will be voting on this proposal within the next several weeks. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, what can our listeners do if they want to learn more about the Convention of States project or find out how they can support it?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. First, I want everyone to know that we will have a Rally for the Republic this Tuesday, 10 o'clock in the morning in Richmond at the Bell Tower right on the Capitol, and I would love for folks to join me there. Michael Ferris will be our keynote speaker, and it's going to be an exciting time. We're not just there to talk or just to listen. We are there to act. And after the rally, we'll be going over to the offices of our legislators to talk to them. If you want more information about that, you can find our state Facebook page. It's Convention of States Virginia on Facebook. You can go to our website at www.conventionofstates.com.
Thank you, Rita. Thank you, Dean, for a very informative program. And thank you, friends, for listening. We'd love to get your feedback, so write us at crossroadsharrisonburg@gmail.com. And tune in next week for a very provocative program on marriage and the law, a very timely issue, as we continue to challenge you to be salt and light, making a difference for Christ at the crossroads where faith and culture meet.